Box with. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte has been discussing race and public education for decades, and it's unfolding once again as Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools tackle student assignment with an eye on both diversity and breaking up concentrations of poverty. These conversations have been among adults, but today we hear from the producer of a film aimed at getting kids to begin discussing race. That film is being screened in Charlotte tomorrow night at Trinity Episcopal School at 6:30 p.m. We have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. The film is titled I'm Not Racist, Am I? And joining us to talk about it and the topic in general is the producer of that film, Andre Robert Lee. Welcome to Charlotte.
Thank you, and good morning.
Nice to have you here. Also with us in our studio is the former North Carolina Teacher of the Year and Charlotte Magazine Charlottean of the Year, now the program director of the Public School Forum of North Carolina, James Ford, a remarkable individual. Welcome back.
Proud to be here. Thank you.
Nice to have you back. Now, let me just explain the travel arrangements, because this is highly unusual. James Ford was supposed to be at a studio in Chapel Hill this morning, but did not go to Chapel Hill because of the weather, so he's with us, thankfully, in our studio here.
Yes, sir.
Andre Robert Lee was supposed to board a plane last night at 6:30 in New York City. The flight was canceled. You rented a car. Well, I don't know if you rented a car or not.
Yeah, you're right.
But you drove all night to get here for this program.
Yes.
Have you slept?
I have not slept.
Take a nap. There's a cot. Really? Well, thank you. That's dedication. That's amazing. All right. Dr. King dreamed of a day when children would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Mm-hmm. And today, it is my anecdotal impression that we see children on the playground, we see children in neighborhoods, and they play with each other, and they don't even know that Johnny is black and Fred is white and Susie is Chinese. They don't see it. Is race still bubbling under the surface in those situations, or is that something they come to see as they grow older and hear parents talking and watch television and look at the news?
Want me to start?
Go for it.
I wanted to give it to you since you drove in, but absolutely. What you hear now is this notion that race has ever gone anyplace. But I find that that's an ahistorical, decontextualized analysis of race. The fact of the matter is race has always been there. And to use a double negative, we'll say that it's never not been there, right? And so the notion that something that predates our formation, something that it seems to be the bedrock of what America is, would suddenly leave because of civil rights era, something that lasts for maybe 10 years, is fallacious. What we've done is we learned how to not talk about it. We've learned how to be very polite, and we've engaged in what is more covert racism than overt racism. And so even on the playgrounds, even in environments where, you know, racial relations and, you know, collegiality exists, there's always a racial component. It goes rarely acknowledged.
And you said that you think that this country is suffering from what you call racial fatigue.
Absolutely.
We're just tired of talking about it. Tired of dealing with it. Never seem to make a lot of traction on it. We take a step forward. We take two steps backward. We think everything's fine. We elect a black president, and we have a shooting in Charleston where a white guy goes in and kills all these people in a church. But some people would say, why bring it up today as these kids are coming into the world and the idea of race apparently or appears to be fading, at least with younger children? Why bring it up to them? And you say?
I say we have a moral obligation to do so. I reject the notion wholeheartedly around some of the language of, you know, injecting race, pulling the race card. People of color play the cards they've been dealt. Okay. And so if we want to extend the metaphor, the deck has always been stacked. And racism, as we understand it, we tend to look at it as individual acts of meanness, right? So we're more nice to each other than we were in the past, but systemic inefficiencies and inequalities, broken along racial lines, is really the true nature of racism. And I would venture to say that the data now suggests that we haven't gone that far back. And so what reason would we have not to acknowledge it when every social system, every institution, there are racial demarcations that are, if not more, exacerbated than in times past?
And your personal life story, Andre, would be illustrative of maybe not race in a negative sense in terms of somebody taunting you because of your race, but you were in a Quaker
private high school,
a prep school, one of the few African-American children there. And although I don't know, but I'm sure they didn't taunt you openly, you knew that you were the black guy.
Yeah, you know, I when it comes to this question of race and its relevance and how it's reflecting our everyday lives, especially with young people, I think we have to be careful in that discussion of racism. It doesn't matter anymore. They don't see it. Because I think that, and this is what we travel with our film, I'm Not Racist, Am I, to many high schools and colleges and churches and conferences. We've been to a couple of hundred around the country already.
Okay.
And we talk with young people, and one of the things that we believe and we say is that race is an untruth that is a truth. You know, and I think about something how I deal with young people in this conversation. I read a book by a woman named Marguerite Wright, and she's at Stanford. It's called I'm Chocolate, You're Vanilla. And it's all about how to talk to pre-adolescent young people and adolescents about race and racism. And it changed my perspective and view on it. And a good thing to think about, she said, is children live in a fantasy world. When a kid says, you're chocolate, they really are thinking about a bowl of chocolate when they say that. They don't have the death of MLK. They don't have the death of Malcolm X. They don't have all these notions that we as adults have. So we as adults place onto children our interpretation and understandings of these situations. Now, existing in this untruth, we have to find a way to help children navigate and go through that, because sadly, the moments happen when we have polarized moments and incidents where children fall into line with the racial constructs. And the question is, where does it begin? Where does it start? Yeah, and when I went to my high school, I was hyper aware of my existence. I was a lower income kid, and I went to my high school, and in my class, there were 7.5 students. There was one biracial student in my class. And he was in on the joke. It was intense to go into that community, that environment. And the hyper-awareness was because it wasn't discussed. You know, I was at a school called the Thatcher School in Ojai, California, and the head of school spoke to me after the screening and discussion. He said, you know, it's interesting to think about racial discussions in schools now, because he saw his children in the school, high school, is really jumping into the conversation. And he said, he looked at me and said, I bet you were in school in the 80s, weren't you? I said, yeah, I was. He said, because you were there during the Reaganomics era. In the 60s, we were talking about race and racism, because it was everywhere you turned, movements were happening. And your time came and it was squashed. You know, it was like, don't talk about it. You're a guest here. Everything's fine. The world is good. Race no longer exists. Racism isn't a problem. I have black friends. I have Latino friends. All is good. And now, with what's happening now with the new movement, I think young people and people in general are back to the conversation, trying to figure out what it means now to engage in it once again.
And you said, James, and I know that you taught at the high school level when you teacher of the year, but you say that kids, they know what's up. They know about race. What do they know? How do they view it?
Well, you know, they can sense that there are racial divisions that predate them. And even if they don't have the historical knowledge or the language to articulate it, they know that all things are not on even keel, that all is not well. And so what I find in these conversations, especially from a historical perspective, because I teach world history. And so what I get to do as part of the curriculum is I can narrate for them where this notion, this false social construct of race, comes into existence, that it's been created from Europe, from, you know, pseudo scientists and lawyers and philosophers, many of which were Enlightenment philosophers, and exported to all of the colonial holdings of European empires. And that's the code that we live by. And then when they understand the way that it manifests themselves, not just in mistreatment or the belief of superiority, but in the outcomes of systems, in other words, institutions that spit out those same racialized outcomes. So it's not just a person treating you as if you're inferior. It's when a system treats you as if you're inferior. Mm-hmm. They begin to understand, wow, so it's not just me, because the way the narrative is spoken now, racism is spoken of like it's a people of color's problem.
Yeah.
That it's an issue that people of color just won't drop, just leave it alone, quit dividing us. And young people, they can look around and they figure it out very quickly.
One of the places that the intersection of race and reality comes through loud and clear is in the school system, in the public schools around the country. And as I said at the beginning of the program, at CMS, which is the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system, we are dealing with this right now because the school board is trying to tackle a pupil assignment program to break up pockets of poverty. It seems to have migrated from race to socioeconomics. But race is still a major part of socioeconomics. At the same time, they're trying to find a new leader for the school system. And at the last school board meeting last week, it was clear that there is a black-white split on the school board, which we'll talk about a little bit later on, I think, because I think that's germane to this conversation. But all these conversations that we're having about race in the schools take place among adults. Both of you have experience in talking about this with kids, you through your film, you through your classes. What would we learn, or would we hear the conversation differently if we listened to the kid as opposed to the adult?
For sure. You know, we our company, Point Made Films, we have a couple of films that we use to spark this conversation. And the first one was my film, The Prep School Negro, that I directed. And it's about my life story. You mentioned earlier my journey going to Germantown Friends School in Philadelphia. And the second one we have is directed by Catherine Wigginton Green. It's the I'm Not Racist, Am I? That we're screening tomorrow night. And we go in schools. We go into schools, and it's interesting, like faculty and staff often start with, we can't do this. This is so scary. The kids are not ready. We can't handle this. What are we going to do? We're opening up Pandora's box. It's going to be really difficult. And we often say, you know what? Actually, calm down. I'm going to this afternoon to Trinity Episcopal First to sit with faculty for the afternoon to do a facilitator's training. And the idea is moving from being a teacher to being a facilitator. And the thought is students are actually – young people are actually much readier, if that's a word, much more ready to have the conversation than adults are. They really jump in and engage. And folks are often very surprised at how articulate and how involved the students are. And they're ready to struggle with the issue. And it's a matter of they get it and it's really relevant for their lives. And I think that adults – sometimes this is what we've been finding in these schools we go to. Adults get really nervous, like, well, I don't want to sound racist or stupid or ignorant or get into a fight or have a difficult time. And we say, our part of our motto is, let's move past the safe space. Let's not call it a brave space. We don't believe in that term for these conversations. Bravery is what John Lewis did when he marched across the Eben Pettus Bridge towards people on horseback with cattle prods and guns aimed at them. We say, let's move into what is an uncomfortable space. Let's get comfortable being uncomfortable. And when we can have these conversations and jump into it and just begin, we say with our films, we are not here to fix racism in one day.
Right.
We're here to lay the seeds and start sparking some of the conversation and dialogue. So my long answer to that is that kids are ready for it. As I learned that, like we call kids, when we call students, students are ready for it and want to dive into this conversation and want some help to try and find answers and some solutions they can work towards.
A lot of students, particularly in the public schools that you work with at Geringer High School, they live racism. They live the effects of racism. They may not know. Maybe they don't know exactly the history of it or why it's there. But when you explain it to them and they start discussing this. What's their attitude toward it? Is it anger? Frustration? What is it?
It's all of those things. It's the full spectrum of human emotions, and I think that that's okay. You know, I think that if you have a beating heart, you should be angry, and I don't care what your racial background is. When you hear and see the way that humans have treated other humans, particularly on something so absurd as race, right? The notion that somebody is, because of their phenotype, their skin color, hair color, nose, and this weird science that they're better than, it's fallacious. And yeah, for, you know, for students, they, you know, they get upset, but they also feel enlightened and feel that they want to contribute to making the world a better place. And that's what I feel like my job is.
James Ford is former North Carolina Teacher of the Year, now the program director of the Public School Forum of North Carolina. Andre Robert Lee is the producer of I'm Not Racist, Am I? A film that will be screened here in Charlotte. We're going to come back and talk about struggling with this issue in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Atrium Animal Hospital and Wellness Center, providing holistic animal health care for 20 years, offering pet parents a strategy to achieve and maintain furry family vitality. AtriumAnimalHospital.com. And the Charlotte Symphony, presenting an evening of works by American composers George Gershwin and Aaron Copland, including Rodeo and Rhapsody in Blue, Friday and Saturday at Belk Theater. Details at charlottesymphony.com. charlottetalks.org. Tonight at 7 o'clock, Charlotte Talks is on the road at Winthrop University. We're talking about the South Carolina primaries in South Carolina with experts and with South Carolina voters. We'll be live tonight on WFAE at 7 p.m., and that show will also be aired tomorrow morning at 9, in case you can't join us there live or you can't listen to us tonight at 7 o'clock. Should be an interesting hour.
On the next Diane Rehm show, the murder of a 13-year-old Virginia girl has raised concerns about anonymous messaging apps. Millions of American teens use services like Kik and Yik Yak that police say have been linked to a growing number of crimes. What parents and teens need to know.
That's the Diane Rehm show ahead from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Andre Robert Lee, the producer of a film called I'm Not Racist, Am I?, which will be screened tomorrow night at 6:30 at Trinity Episcopal School. It's a free screening of that film. James Ford is also with us, former North Carolina Teacher of the Year, taught world history at Garinger High School, and is now the program director of Public School Forum of North Carolina. You shot your film, I'm Not Racist, Am I?, in New York City in 2014, and you say that it shows students struggling with this issue. In what way?
We actually shot it in 2013.
Okay, excuse me?
Oh, no, you're right, 2014. Excuse me, you're right. My lack of sleep's coming in.
That's right.
The struggle we saw with students was, you know, we started out with taking them through a workshop run by the People's Institute, and they were given a definition looking at racism from a systemic perspective versus individual meanings perspective. Mm-hmm. And they jumped in, and they were very intellectual. They were great kids. They're different ethnic backgrounds, different financial backgrounds, different public schools, private schools. And they jumped in, and they were ready. They sort of got it. But they were very polite with one another, and we had to get them to a stage of saying, okay, we need to really talk about what you're feeling and thinking.
When you say polite, they were being careful with the language they used because they didn't want to offend the other people in the group?
Yeah.
Why is that not productive? Why is being polite not productive? Walking on eggshells.
Because you need to have the hard conversations. You need to be uncomfortable, and we need to hear the differences, and we need to hear the problems, and they need to work them out. You know, if people don't come together and have these hard dialogues, nothing happens. You know,
so the wounds have to what? Be opened so they don't fester? Is that what it?
The wounds have to be acknowledged. The wounds have to be acknowledged. I think we ignore our history in our American society, mm-hmm. and until we can deal with the truth and folks can come forward. I love when we have a screening or a discussion, and someone says, "I totally disagree. This movie is wrong. It's not correct." And I'm like, that's excellent. Who wants to respond to that? When we facilitate, we never tell people what to think. We let the audience work it out in the conversation.
So give me an example of what the conversation might have been like prior to you prodding them to say, let's be honest, let's open it up. Let's not be careful here. Let's be open. What's the difference in the conversation?
I think the difference is I can speak to my own personal experience. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school, I heard a lot of things that hit me really hard and felt really wrong. Felt really judgmental, and I didn't talk about it. I just said, well, I'm a guest here at this high school. I don't want to rock the boat. I feel like a guest in a stranger's house. I should appreciate I have a scholarship. I should appreciate I'm here. I didn't say, what you said just really offended me, and your comment that dismisses and categorizes all people of color in this one limited view because you don't interact with people different from the way you look.
Right.
You feel comfortable making a statement, and I didn't have the strength to stand up and say, actually, no, that's not my experience. I disagree. What I'm seeing now is students saying, actually, I don't agree with that statement. You know, we have a really great moment in the film. One student, she's a white student. She goes to very mixed. She went to a very mixed high school, kids of all different backgrounds, downtown New York City, and her boyfriend was biracial, and she called him a halfie. You know, and for her, it was an affectionate term. He even approved it. He liked it. When they all came together, she referred to biracial people as halfies. And some folks group were like, whoa, you can't say halfie. You know, and they didn't for a long time. They would just shake their head and say, Martha, no one said, hi, I don't like that you use halfie because it bothers me for this reason. It took a good 8-9 months. And these children had all stepped in the room together to agree to have this hard conversation. To be blunt about it, the success of systemic racism is that we often take care of white people. Mm. You know, we do not challenge white people's perspectives and thoughts and ideas when they hit us. Because that's what we're trained to do.
Don't rock the boat.
Right. Yeah. Don't rock the boat. Don't cause trouble. Or the pushback can be so intense and so hard. Mm-hmm. You know, you're playing the race. They're playing the race card. I'm a good person. You can't say that what I said was offensive to you because I didn't mean for it to be offensive. And I said, well, actually, it was offensive. And let's talk about it. Not shut down because you said something to me, but how could we engage in a hard dialogue and move to the next level?
I was just going to interject. I think that's the irony of sort of the anti-politically correct dialogue that we hear right now. Everybody wants to do away with political correctness. And what that tends to mean to me is people want to speak without thinking first and they want to not have to deal with the consequences. But I don't like political correctness mm-hmm. because I feel like it thwarts the conversation. But what people don't realize is that sword cuts two ways. Mm-hmm. Black people of color have been incredibly politically correct. Yep. You better learn early on how not to arouse the anger, suspicion, distrust of white people, because it could be the difference between you being able to be alive and thrive. You could lose your job. I mean, you could lose your freedom. So that thing cuts both ways. He's right. We tend to pander to the emotions, to the feelings of white people primarily because it is the brand of racism in our society is white supremacy. Mm-hmm. That term makes people uncomfortable, but racism is a generic term. It could be multidirectional. In our society, though, the most common in Western society, white supremacy is the brand of racism that we're used to dealing with. It usually doesn't go other ways because black people aren't in charge of institutions. We don't have institutional power to enact, right? There's nothing allegedly about black racism, if it does exist, that thwarts people's life, liberty, or pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. But if you look at that the other way, that's how it tends to flow.
Mm-hmm. I have some dear friends that are very close to me, and I know that if I had spoken back to them about a lot of things they said to me over the years, they would not be my friends today. And it's that moment of like taking care of them.
Well, then should they be your friends?
That's a good question. That's a question I've been asking myself as I do this work, you know, mm-hmm. but when you're in high school, you're in college, you're fresh out of college and just beginning life, it's a very difficult spot to be in when you turn on the TV, turn on the radio, open the newspaper, walk down the street, and you were told that your opinion, your ideas will reduce your ability to participate in society.
Now, your film is more than a film. It's an experiment. And it's a conversation. It follows 12 New York City students through a year-long series of, mm-hmm. as I understand it, workshops, because I haven't seen the film yet, mm-hmm. Exploring race, culture, identity, and institutional racism at Calhoun School, which is a prep school on the affluent Upper West Side of New York City. Would these conversations have been the same? Would there have been the same struggle had you filmed this in a public school in New York City?
Well, here's the rub on this. Actually, we had three students from Calhoun. Calhoun okay. was a sponsor of the film. They got the grant from the Kellogg Foundation.
Okay,
but we had students from public schools and all private right. schools. So we had different ethnic backgrounds, different socioeconomic backgrounds, and that's what really made it work. That white girl I mentioned, actually, her name is Martha. Mm-hmm. She actually went to a public school in New York City, and she was one of the. She just spoke, you know, when she came in, she was ready to participate and felt very free to have the conversation. And I think that's what really helped us. You got to come see this movie. Come on, man.
I'll see it too.
Well, I haven't seen it yet because you haven't screened it yet.
Yeah.
You have two sets of people here. You've got people who were definitely touched by race. They live it. Mm-hmm. They live the existence of it. And you have people who, if you're white, you really are unaware of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unless you're confronted with it or you see what happened in Charleston, mm-hmm. which is the result of it, your life is pretty much not touched by it. How do those conversations differ among those very different sets of people?
I've seen it on many different levels. You've heard my own educational experience detailed and so forth. Helms has this paradigm for racial identity formation, right? And has like six different stages. And there are those who never have contact with people that look outside of their racial category. And then there's people who, once they encounter them, they kind of go along this spectrum of being enlightened, but not, you know, understanding how things work systemically. People who have never had to live around, go to school with, have any meaningful interaction with, could not possibly know or have any sort of experiential knowledge at the intricacies and the architecture of race or racism. And so in a way, they're not really to blame for their lack of knowledge on that thing. However, once one comes into the knowledge of something, in other words, once they've seen something or heard people of color confess their lived experiences, now there is no longer the excuse of naivete, right? You have to at least peer in, because if you really care about somebody, right, and oftentimes that's the defense I have, black friends or whatnot, then when somebody tells you, look, this is really a problem for me, the reaction should be empathy. You know, oh, really? I didn't know that. How can we fix that? But instead, what we get is a reflexive kind of rejection of what you're making that up. And it's very insulting.
Well, just as the old film in the 1960s on television of the water cannons being turned on civil rights marchers in Selma and other places in the Deep South. Yes. Just as that shocked a lot of white people and made them realize, whoa, we're doing this in America? Mm-hmm. What do you think of what's been going on with the police around the country and in places like Ferguson and in Charleston and places like that? Is that a wake-up call for white folks?
Well, see, I study these movements historically, and you're right. The civil rights movement used the media masterfully to awaken the conscience of white America primarily, but America at large.
I don't know that the civil rights movement was responsible for putting those films on television. That was the networks.
No, they were very strategic about knowing this in public spaces, right, knowing that if these things were into the television sets and family households, they would respond. It would elicit a response. What's happened since the civil rights era is we've grown callous to those images. And so I'm really kind of enamored by the psychology of it all, because you see more egregious, more flagrant abuses of power. You see people literally being choked out, being shot to death. And now there's kind of an insensitivity to it now. It's almost like, well, that's what happens. Or, we tend to view blackness as synonymous with struggle, right? And so at some point in time, you're not moved by it anymore. And so every time one of these situations happen, the more inhumane they are, I have to take a break from social media, because I'm sitting here waiting for how people are going to compute that this is justifiable. And in the process, I feel like we lose our humanity in doing that. I don't think it has the same effect as it did in the 60s.
Speaking of social media, have you had a conversation about race and racism with your kids? What approach did you take? We'd like to have you share your thoughts with us on Facebook or Twitter, or even email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. You want to jump into this, Andre?
Yeah, I it's interesting. A friend of mine's, her name is Dr. Imani Perry. She's at Princeton University, and she just got pulled over by police and was frisked and thrown. And this is the first time it was this close. I mean, in this new level, it's been close because I have family, friends. I've had it happen to myself. You know, I have a different experience than you do, Mr. Ford, in terms of my reaction to it all. I think there is tremendous power in what's happening now. I remember when the events first started being recognized. There was a great article. There was an article in the New York Times. I won't say the author's name. And he said, it's really amazing now that this problem of racism is coming out of the shadows. And I read that and I got so PO'd. I was so angry about it. And I was like, it's never been in the shadows. It's been in the shadows for you, because you can't see it. So this exposure we're getting, it's a terrible moment of excitement that is happening in present, because it's folks are finally looking and saying, whoa, this is really happening. It's not just people telling me this happened. An analogy we use when we talk about racism is that racism is, I wish I could claim this, but I can't claim it. Racism is like Bigfoot. When you say you saw it, people say you're crazy. And everyone has a different description of what it looks like. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why we help the students look at this definition by a social scientist that talks about the misuse of power plus racial prejudice equals racism. You know, and the whole idea of focusing on the notion of power, you know, is a way of re-looking at the situation. So I think that what's happening now and what we're seeing today is interesting. I just had a good conversation with Mr. Vernon Jordan last weekend in Atlanta at the Stouffer Scholars Foundation reunion, a great group started here in the South. And he said something that was so powerful with the discussion of the Black Lives Matter movement, where he was excited about it, but also critical of it, mm-hmm. in a sense of, like, let's make sure we pay attention to history. You know, And I've seen a lot of conversations with the young people fighting the old people, you know, and it's like, wait a minute, there's a lot of work that's been done already. Let's make sure we have a connection as opposed to a confrontation with each other. I get wanting solutions and answers right now and rallying and protesting, but organizing and knowing your history and actually knowing some of these black lives that do matter, mm-hmm. historically speaking, is really relevant and important.
Well, you teach world history and you had these discussions, I'm sure. And I know you did when you taught world history at Derringer High School. And you say it's okay, James, to be angry about race because not all history is glorious.
Right, right.
The students understand that? Do the parents understand that? Administrators understand that?
I'm not sure whether parents, administrators do or not, but students certainly do. We tackle that from the outset. One of the first units is predicated on historical themes, historical thinking, context. And, you know, history depends on who it's written by, you know, and if it's written by certain groups, they may upplay certain situations and downplay others. And, you know, you have to take the good with the bad. Just last year, we saw the kind of AP U.S. history debate when they came out with the new framework. You guys covered it here. The concern from those in certain parts of the community was that it focused too much on the negative parts of America and didn't talk enough about American exceptionalism. And particularly, they said it focused too much on Native American and African American subjugation. Mm. And the problem with that is that's how institutional racism works. Yeah. It's a very sophisticated network that involves education, involves the finance sector, involves the schools. And you know, you black out certain things and you whitewash other things so that image of America is portrayed and it's not realistic. It's not public education. That's public relations.
Do people see this is my opinion. I don't rarely give my opinion, but do people see the links between being black and being poor and the reason why there are pockets of poverty within the schools, which dates back to slavery and Jim Crow and deprivation and keeping people down?
Yes.
Do people not make those connections anymore?
No.
Yeah, I think it's we're in a new space of trying to force that. The reason why I made The Prep School Negro,
That's
my other movie, mm-hmm. the one I directed. Mm-hmm. The reason why I made that film, I walked into my high school and I looked around and I met people and I said, hey, these folks are not that much. Some of these folks are not smarter than my family and my parents. Why do they have so much and we have so little? Mm-hmm. You know, and then I start going out to the suburbs and seeing people with the exact same jobs as my parents, but they had larger houses, they had land, they had cars. And at the time, I couldn't identify the distribution of wealth and understand it from that perspective. As an adult, I've studied redlining, I've studied how banks function, the GI Bill, et cetera. I entered that school thinking, well, we're less, we're not as smart, we don't work as hard. That was systemic racism working in my head. When I began to get the facts and say, actually, it's outside of me, and we're not to blame for this. We weren't allowed to participate
right.
at the level that folks were. So I think people, when you have power, you don't want to let it go. You know, and the discussion we have with people, young people and adults is this is not a discussion of confiscation. We're not here to take away what you have. We're just saying, I quote one of the kids in the film, his name is Kalik. He said this, Kalik Davis, he said, we just want it too. We don't want you to have less. We just want to have access to the same privileges you have. Mm-hmm. You know, and that when if people can come together and say, oh yeah, everyone should have equal access. I had a great debate with a kid at a school in Connecticut where after hearing our conversation, he said, aren't you talking about socialism because you want everyone to have the same access? I said, actually, I think that's democracy.
Mm-hmm. We have to take a break. That's Andre Robert Lee, the producer of I'm Not Racist, Am I? Also with us, James Ford, former North Carolina Teacher of the Year. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at NC Initiative and Talk It Out NC, a program that helps parents address underage drinking and initiate age-appropriate conversations with children from 8 to 18. TalkItOutNC.org. And Charlotte Concerts, presenting Diane Shore at CPCC's Halton Theater, Friday, February 26th at 8 p.m. Tickets available at charlotteconcerts.org. The murder of a 13-year-old Virginia girl has raised concerns about anonymous messaging apps. Millions of American teenagers use services like Kik that police say have been linked to a growing number of crimes. What parents and teens need to know. The topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Hi, this is Raven Barkley, company dancer with the Charlotte Ballet. I've been paired to dance with WFAE President Joe O'Connor for the ballet's 2016 Dancing with the Stars Gala on March 5th. Every ticket purchased or dollar donated in support of the O'Connor Barkley team will be shared equally between the Charlotte Ballet and WFAE. One of the hallmarks of ballet training is repetition, so feel free to donate often. Visit charlotteballet.org/gala for more information or to contribute. Thank you.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. I'm Not Racist, Am I? Is a movie that will be screened here tomorrow night at the Trinity Episcopal Church at 6:30. It's free. The producer of I'm Not Racist, Am I? Andre Robert Lee is with us in the studio along with James Ford, former North Carolina Teacher of the Year, taught world history at Garinger High School, and now is the program director of Public School Forum of North Carolina. The purpose of the film is to start a conversation about race and to move from our comfort zone into our uncomfort zone and learn how to stay there long enough to understand the other side of the coin, the other perspective. When you move, when you allow yourself to go into this area of uncomfortableness, and I know it can be really uncomfortable, are there positive outcomes all the time? Or are there sometimes when, as you said, you had friends who've said things that if you confronted them, they wouldn't be your friend anymore? Does that end friendships? Does it end relationships?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I think that folks, you know, something we say about our workshops and work we've done is no one's died in the making of this film, you know, and in the conversations. Being uncomfortable is not so bad. And we want all people to do that because I have seen people move forward and change. You know, sometimes it may take, I won't tell, but I have a friend, it took him 20 years to understand what he and I had been debating in college. Mm-hmm. He finally got it as an adult when it affected his children. So I think that I really believe, and I've seen that positive results come out of that conversation. It's hard at first, but you make it.
We talked about this in the break, and I was struggling to figure out how to bring it up on the air and make it sound the same way as it did in the 90-second break. But let's just do it this way. Let me be politically incorrect.
There you go.
You are a producer of two movies. You're a director of one, producer of a second movie. Uh-huh. Now, you may not be Steven Spielberg rich, but you have made inroads in a profession that is important to you. You are the North Carolina Teacher of the Year. Both of you, no matter how you categorize it, have made it. So people would say to you, well, you made it.
Yeah. Why can't everybody else? It's the natural temptation to focus on the outliers and not on the distribution, right? It's the unscrupulous, unempirical thing where you lift an anecdote and say, I know a guy who, so why can't everybody else, right? Like, this experience is generalizable. It's also incredibly presumptive in assuming that you know what it took to get to here, wherever here is. Mm-hmm. And when you compare where we are to our counterparts similarly situated with education, income, where are you really fixated? It's a deviation from social science, right? The fact of the matter is, there are a lot of impediments for me to get to where I am. And the fact that I am where I am is a testimony to God, to faith, to a whole lot of interventions. But there are a ton of people who we don't see, who lie in the shadows, who did not make it. And statistically, there are far more of them than there are of me.
But Arthur, isn't that the true of any race? Isn't a lot of what happens to you in life luck, who you know, being at the right place at the right time, and then having the talent to do whatever it is you want to do once you're given the shot at it?
If that were true, mm-hmm. you wouldn't have such color-coded demarcations mm-hmm. throughout the social strata.
Explain that. Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is that assuming that we really have a colorblind society, that it's a meritocracy, would there be any sort of racialized pattern to who makes it and who does it? But what you see are rigidly racial gaps in every single sector, from income, from wealth, to achievement, to arrest rates, to sentencing, to every institution, you name one, there are racial disparities. So if we're colorblind, our outcome should be colorblind instead of color coded.
Is that how you explain the Oscars? Oh, this is liberal Hollywood we're talking about, and not a single black nominee.
The Oscars, and I have my inside view, the Oscars are all hype. You know, I worked at Miramax for a very long time. Uh-huh. I saw the secrets. At the end of the day, the Oscars are about 3 to 4,000 people who are all friends. And the majority of the group are white males, and they vote for each other. It's that simple, you know? So it's almost the conversation is great to see people protest and work, but it's almost until that structure, that system changes, it's almost not worth talking about. And in terms of the question you raised.
But the Grammys aren't like that.
But the Grammys are decided by a small group also, and they're a little more diverse. And it's about money and it's about power. It's a wonderful, successful business model that tells you what is the best, which is, in my mind, a myth that we have
it's
to
nonsense. Against.
Yeah. So I think that to go back to that first question of like, I made it, you know, without going to all the moments and incidents that strike against that chord or that notion of how I made it, I will say that I push for the moment where when you walk into a bank and I walk into a bank, I want us to have the exact same experience, you know? And that notion that's in people's heads when they see you coming and they see me coming, for those who don't know, Mike is white and I'm black. When they see you coming, they see me. that's what I do for a living. I help people know who they are. When they see you coming for a loan, they see me coming for a loan, a different experience happens. Until that changes, and I heard Angela Davis once say this, until we understand the root of the problem.
What is the root of that problem? Is it the media having shown black on black murders in the African American community? Does it stem from Jim Crow? Does it stem from slavery? Why is it? And because you're absolutely right. I have black friends who tell me they get followed around department stores.
I do.
Because they're black, right. And they think that the shopkeepers think they're going to shoplift. What is that? What is that fear? What is the thing when you're walking down the street and it's nighttime?
Yeah.
And a black guy's walking opposite you, and you go,
I'll push that question back on you and say that I think it's important to explore what are your experiences, what are your notions, what happened to you to make you feel that way, what influences your decision making, and that I'm saying you understood. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at taking care of you in this moment. It's what are your experiences that make you believe and feel that way? You know, I often use this analogy. I say racism is like a big boat. And we're all on this boat going from shore to shore. And the folks with power are driving the boat and telling us where to go and how to function. And we are down below in the galleys and even first class fighting about what it all means and what's happening. You weren't nice to me. You're racist, which means nothing.
Right.
You have to go upstairs and say, who has the power and who's telling us to think this way? Let us drive the boat. So my answer to that is that we have to look inside of us and really deconstruct. This is what we ask the children to do in the film. Deconstruct and understand, how did you arrive at this notion and how did you arrive at this? We all make assumptions. We all make presumptions. I say, I do it myself. I say, forgive yourself. Don't let that judgment carry weight. And then try to move through and meet someone and interact with them based on the content of their character, as opposed to the superficial judgment you pass when you walk up next to someone or walk in someone's face and experience your own personal prejudice and all that fun stuff.
So I kind of want to delve into that and take more of a historical angle, obviously. When you talk about what's the root of that, first of all, it's every institution. So it is the media. It is the government. It is laws. It is everything you can think of coordinating together to create this image. But the root of it stems from, I guess you could call it colonial America, right? So it's a human thing in the sense that in order to have social dominance for one group to dominate another, you need to justify that by identifying something that is explicitly different, but not just different, deficient. So that you say, we bring this nation into existence based upon the belief that all men are created equal and die by the creator, okay? But not that group of people. There's something different about them, and that difference allows us to treat them differently. So the Native Americans, yeah, that doesn't really include them. That allows us to dispossess them of their land. The Africans, that allows us to enslave them. So it's what's needed, a coordinated effort to reinforce social dominance. And any group can do that, but it's the power-holding group that's able to put that into action.
And it's a snowball, isn't mm-hmm. it? I mean, if we have a habit, and we do in this country, of incarcerating black people mm-hmm. at a much higher rate than mm-hmm. white people, and when we have, I've forgotten the percentages now, but something like 20% of the adult African-American population is in prison, mm-hmm. usually for things that wouldn't get a white person mm-hmm. put in prison, mm-hmm. we start to look at black people as criminals.
Yeah,
or potential criminals.
Right. Yep.
Because of the color of their skin. Well, they're those people. That's yeah. part of that, isn't it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And you and I'm a mass communication major myself. And so think about this. The first popular culture in America were minstrel shows. Right. Traveling minstrel shows where whites would dress up in blackface and make a mockery of black people. The right. first major full-length film was
Al Jolson.
The first talkie was yeah. Al Jolson. But the first film was Birth of a Nation. Right. D.W. Griffith, the first blockbuster film. So
incredibly
about
racist
this.
Movie.
Incredibly racist. All of them. First popular culture, first movie, first talkie are all films that the first priority is let's depict black people negatively with this new technology. Think about that level of priority, right? Mm-hmm. So like the first thing you do is let's make sure we demonize black behavior, make them seem appear as criminals. And Tom Burrell, the father of African-American advertising, has a great book on this called Brainwashing, where he yeah. talks about this propaganda effort that has really begun ever since 1776 up until now, where you see black characters, black characteristics recycled over and over again that and give us this impression. And guess what? Black people believe this stuff too about ourselves. Mm. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy mm-hmm. so that we end up participating oftentimes in our own destruction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring this up because I alluded to this in the beginning of the show. In these conversations about race at the school board level, we had a conversation or a comment last week by a white guy who has a black son-in-law and who has mixed-raced grandchildren. And after he prefaced the conversation with that information, and after this discussion about what color the next superintendent ought to be and how we do this school assignment thing, mm-hmm. he said essentially, it's time to get over it. What happened 200 years ago, we need to get over it and move on. We need to start looking at people's abilities and accomplishments and not their race. And that's gotten a little flack.
I push back on that all the time, and I want to say this also. Let's give a shout out to Nate Parker, who made the new Birth of a Nation, right. you know, to take action, turn this around. In terms of that moment when people say, "I'm colorblind, I don't believe in this problem anymore," I say this directly. Okay, who was at your last dinner party? Hmm. Who was at the wedding? Look around your community where you live. Look around your school. Do you think it's by chance that it looks the way it looks, or is it by design? I ask people to ask that question, right? Because that discussion of like, life is better, you're successful, and also there are so many poor white people in America. You know, there are more poor white people than there are poor black people, because that's just numerically speaking, there are just more white people in America. So I always push back on that notion, ask people to really stop back and look around your community's neighborhood and be honest with yourself about the way the world works.
You mentioned the word colorblind, and mm-hmm. we've had this discussion on this program before. There are people who don't want us to be colorblind, and the kids in the film, either this film or the other, and I forgot which one I'm quoting here, know that America is not post-racial, and they don't want it to be. Well, if they don't want it to be post-racial, they want to focus on race, how do we get beyond the problem of race? If we're not colorblind, if I don't look at you and see you as a black man first and then whatever it is later, how do we get beyond this black-white divide?
I really believe that we have to do the work we haven't done yet and actually talk about what that difference is, what it means, and understand the history that we've denied and not talked about for so long. You know, slavery was a long time ago. I didn't have any slaves. My grandparents didn't have slavery. That's not what the conversation is about. The conversation is that there is lack of equity, lack of justice, and an imbalance in our society. What can we do to turn that around? Students often say, why are we watching this film? You know, and we say this, we're not here to make white people feel bad. We're also here not to take care of white people. Mm-hmm. We're here to say there's a problem in our world. And either you – this is what I stand on. Either you think women and people of color are lesser individuals or there's imbalance in our society. Where do you stand in that conversation? I really believe in coming forward with that. I don't believe there's gray area in that conversation. So my thoughts really center around – we have to understand what our role is in this conversation. And it doesn't mean you have to go out and be the next president. It'd be great if the next president – I hope the next president is listening and takes part in this conversation. Our director, Catherine Wigginton Green, on the Racist MI, she does a really great analogy where she talks about she's an environmentalist, you know, but mm-hmm. she's never going to tie herself to a tree. Mm-hmm. But she will ride her bike. She will not litter. She'll pick up litter if she sees it. You know, she gets her little ice pick out and chips away at the problem. And I really believe that doing that work is the solution, part of the steps to the solution to turning this problem around.
Also, you know, I'm one of those race conscious guys. I think that colorblindness exonerates us from doing the hard work. Mm-hmm. It makes us say, well, everybody's just the same. And what by doing that, you diminish the significance that race has. Now, we said race didn't exist in the true sense and it was created, but it does. It's alive. It's our Frankenstein. We created it.
Right.
And it's murderous, right? So you have to acknowledge that. Acknowledge that there are differences, because the hard work comes in really trying to figure out how are we different, how are we the same. That takes effort.
Does it start with young people?
I think every social movement starts with young people, but it can't just start with young people, because I don't want to give in to the idea that it's too late for older folk. But I think that if we're truly building the future, then yes, you have to begin that work with young people. And that's why what you're doing is so admirable, because, you know, some people are stuck in their ways. But everybody has a responsibility to do it. And that's not racist. Mm-hmm. People tend to use talking about race as racist. That word has been taken over and misappropriated. Mm-hmm. And so let's just, all your listeners, please stop doing that. That's not what racism is. You know, discussing race is not racist. It's being race conscious. And that's something we need to do. We're different, but that doesn't make us lesser or greater. We need to explore those differences and appreciate those because, hey, you know, we're all in this together, ultimately so.
Mm-hmm. I have less than 30 seconds left. As you've taken this film around the country, what has been the result? What kind of things have you seen come out of this?
I've seen people change. I've seen people say, I don't know how to solve this exactly, but I know that I'm going to talk about it and explore and try and figure out what I can do. That acknowledgement that there is a problem and that we all have a role in fixing that problem are the steps towards making the world a better place.
Andre Robert Lee is the producer who drove all night from New York City to be on this program this morning. I'm Not Racist, Am I? Is the name of his film. James Ford, former Teacher of the Year here in North Carolina from Geringer High School, now Program Director of Public School Forum of North Carolina. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talk.